Welcome to the Meat Company.
This is our first cut educational series.
Yes.
This is our first time broadcasting the first cut.
We've never done the broadcast before.
We're essentially merging the first cut with from the Butcher's Block web show. We felt this was a good opportunity. One, because it's cool to have Steve in the house.
Yes.
We have also a really fun audience. We have some cattlemen. We've got some consumers of your product here, Michael.
A few of them.
And we got a couple of first-timers. So on top of that, though, this is a great community outreach. You know, the premise of the shop, and I want to make sure not to just talk to the mic, but talk to our audience here because they're live. But the premise of the shop is all about sustainably and humanely raised cattle and animals, as well as a grass finish and nutritional focus. So having Steve here to talk about his life as a rancher and what that means to not only the shop, but to the consumer is going to be a great opportunity for us to learn.
First thing I would point out is all those talking points that you just mentioned, you know, a grass-finished product, a humanely raised product, is unique. And when you just say those things, and I think you'd agree with this, that most people just think that that's automatic. That, yeah, all cows are grass-finished in the U.S., and they're all treated humanely, and none of them are pumped full of antibiotics and hormones. And it's important to point out that what you do is unique.
We're unique, yes, but we're not so unique that we're in a minority, that big of a minority. More and more people are becoming more aware of the better ways of treating their cattle. The National Cattlemen's Association has a program called Beef Quality Assurance, if I'm correct. And they teach people, I don't care if you're starting out or you've been doing it for 50 years or whatever, they teach people different ways of handling cattle, handling humanely, and down to the point of how to paint your fences to so the cattle will walk in, walk more calmly, and less stress on them, less stress on you, less stress on your horse. At the end of the day, the less stress you have, the happier everyone is.
I think those are some interesting points, too, that we want to make sure kind of get the ideas flowing and the questions flowing. Because, again, we do have people in the shop. This is largely a discussion for our live audience here with us who want to learn more about the lifestyle and what those aspects, you know, really are all about and how that affects the product they're bringing in. But we want to make sure that we give them the opportunity as well to ask questions and, you know, really pick Steve's brain.
Absolutely.
I did post, housekeeping-wise, I did post a question. No one else may be brave enough to answer, but I'll bring it up later. So that's my first teaser. I'm also excited to have food share representatives in the audience today because, as we know with the First Cut series, part of the base of this educational series is our awareness for the hungry in the community and giving back. So a portion of this event, as well as all of our other events, back to Food Share, and it's a really good opportunity for us to have them in our sessions experiencing what we're talking about so they can pass it on to other people and say, hey, this is a pertinent topic or this is really cool information that other people should get involved with. But then again, acknowledging the benefits we have and the beauty of being able to shop here at the Ventura Meat Company, not everyone has that opportunity, so we want to give back.
It's one of the coolest things that I like about working with Jason, and I work with him on a lot of different things, and Jason does, he's a foodie, he loves food, he loves it served in a local context, but he can't talk about food without considering people that don't have any of it, and that is also unique. So it's always a no-brainer to work with Jason because nobody emphasizes that aspect of the conversation of food more than you do, I think.
And I'd imagine, Steve, that taking on the lifestyle of a rancher, and we're going to get into really what that means to you in a minute, but there's a certain love and passion for the craft that translates into what Food Share and other organizations like that do, where they're involved with the community, they're sharing their drive and their love for what they do. So with that being said, let's talk a little bit about being a rancher. What's a basic day for you look like? What's that mean?
Aside from getting up at what, four in the morning probably? I don't know.
Yeah, old dark 30. we normally get up pretty early. We want to get out there so that we can catch the cattle. Not catch them, but...
I like that term, though. You could say catch, right?
Well, view them before they start brushing up. You go to, it's a lot easier to look at the cattle and see what the babies are doing when they're coming to water, rather than to ride through a bunch of brush and stuff. And usually the mamas will be hiding their babies. So you can find mama, but a lot of times finding that little baby is tough. And you know, and then also you can see how she's doing, how she's walking. You know, does she need some doctoring? Does the baby need to be brought in and giving extra care, like some hay or maybe a medicine or vaccination or something? Is the baby stressed because of the heat? You know, I mean, could you get these hot days and cold days and hot days and cold days? You start getting pneumonia and such like that. It takes a toll on you. So also, it takes a toll on your horses. Yeah. So, I mean, we work all our cattle horseback. We work, we don't use any motorized vehicles. So everything how we get around is either on foot, which I'm against because walking is, I don't do that. But we ride horses and stuff. And so, yeah. And also the cattle, they respond a lot calmer to a horse than they do to a motorized vehicle.
Sure.
And a lot calmer to a horse than they do to a person on foot. At least our cattle do.
Now, interesting. When we're thinking through on foot and riding a horse, that means a lot of acreage, right? And I noticed on your website, Farm and Ranch has been family owned and operated since 1979, which at risk of offending or dating myself is 34 years, right?
Right.
Because I just hit my 1978 birthday last month.
Can't take this guy
anywhere. Can't take me anywhere. I'm spilling beer over here.
It's all right.
How many acres has your family owned since 1979?
Well, actually, we started out, my dad had a place in Nevada, and it was 800 acres deeded and 15,000 acres BLM. So we would run cattle on the BLM, which is adjacent to the deeded.
What is a PLM?
BLM, Bureau of Land Management, is U.S. government.
Okay.
I see.
And we ran cattle on there in the wintertime, and then we summer them on the home ranch. And then after the ranch was sold, we went and started leasing different places. And where I am presently, we are leasing from the Cañada Larga Ranch.
Okay.
And Mike Williams is the manager there. And he has. So that's basically how we do it. We started out running longhorn cattle, but the quality of the beef and their temperament was a little to be desired. And so we switched over to Angus, because Angus is a more docile cow. She's a better mothering cow than we found on a lot of other British or continental breeds. And her calves reflect her personality and her disposition. So that's why we selected the Angus. Now, we have there's a lot of different strains of it, not strains, but I guess bloodlines of Angus.
Sure.
The bloodlines we have come out of San Luis Obispo.
Wow.
Yeah,
my brain is getting so full of stuff.
I noticed your eyes lit up for a second. Like, I could see the questions flowing right now.
Where to even start? Temperament and all that stuff. But even like how closely I work with beef on a daily basis, it's things that even I'm just decidedly ignorant about that realm of. And that's why I think this is such an interesting opportunity.
Well, and you just had a side come in from Steve yesterday.
It was a hole.
You had a hole. Okay, so you had a hole.
Yeah.
And how many pounds did that come in at approximately?
Well, it's 760 pounds, and that's
carcass weight.
Yeah, right. And that's I've been saying it since yesterday. That's about 200 pounds more than what we normally receive. And, I mean, that's just a whole other bracket of conversation we could get into is what – I mean – those nuances about size and things. I mean, how do those things manifest themselves? How does a cow get to be 200 pounds bigger than the others?
Well, he was a little tougher to find. He hid a lot better than normal.
So he just grew a little longer. I see. Yeah. So he was just out there longer.
Right.
So they all have the potential.
Yeah, they all do. Some of them do more than others. But and he came, and his mom walks around at 1,400 pounds.
I see.
And she's a big old cow.
That's a big heifer.
Yeah. And but the American Angus is a lot larger than the Aberdeen Angus, which came out of Scotland.
Okay.
I mean, that's the base of the herd,
right,
of the breed. But American Angus is crossed with Holstein, and so now you got a lot bigger cows, and every once in a while you'll get an Angus that's supposed to be pulled, and poop, here comes these little horns. You're going, okay, where'd that come from, you know?
And that's from the Holstein side?
Yeah, that's just a throwback. I got a two-year-old heifer now, and I know her mom, and I know her dad, and she's got horns about 4 inches long.
Phenomenal.
That's it.
And Michael, my wheels are turning a little bit too, because when we're talking about the mom, and you really are expressing, Steve, in a way as if you can identify them by looking at it. And I'm sure you can, so I'm not trying to diminish that, but how's that documentation laid out? How do you keep track of those? What's your method for keeping track of your herd?
Well, we air tag them. They're all numbered and air tagged. But, you know, it's like your kids or like a teacher. I mean, they don't ear tag their students. They should, maybe. but after a while, they know their...
Son of a...
It's okay.
They know the kids by name. And so, I mean, you can look at your cows and, you view them enough. I mean, you get some of these big outfits, like John Lacey's outfit. You know, he's not going to do that.
Right.
Because he's got way too many. But
right.
We're not that way. We're not that big.
Right.
And there's a lot of guys who, you know, they'll run 600-700 head, and they'll know them. They'll know those cows.
Yeah. How many do you have, Steve?
Right now we have 100 head.
Nice. Right. Do you consider yourself a small outfit then?
Absolutely.
And I noticed a little head bobbing in the audience. So I'm going to ask Mr. Atwater, how many head of cattle do you guys manage?
In the whole year, 400.
About 400. All right. And what tier would that put you at typically?
Small.
You're still small. So for both of you, what is the general breakdown then of tiers when we talk about a rancher's herd? Hmm. Is there a small, medium, and large, or is it arbitrary?
You know, the average herd in the state of California is 50 head.
Average herd in California is 50 head.
10, 5, 50, 40,
yeah.
And a few guys that have thousands.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, that raises another. We talked about this the other day.
We
want to wait to the expert. So, Steve, at 100, and considering that a lot of ranchers in the state are doing anywhere from 5 to 40 maybe and still considered very small, what is your market? How are you distributing your steer and your beef?
Well, our market focus right now is like Michael's Place and, you know, several small, high-quality butcher shop.
So you're selling direct to the person who's handing it directly to the customer.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
Well, now let's get inside that. Not selling direct, really. I mean, do you sell, like, if a customer wanted to buy a side of beef from you and have it butchered, say at Ken's Place, is that something that an end user or a consumer could come to you and do?
Yes. It depends upon where they live. Mm. If they live next door to you, I'm going to tell them to come to you.
It's a businessman too, right?
But if they're they live in Santa Paula, or they live in North Hollywood, or something like that. Yeah, you know, I'll deal with that directly.
I wonder too, going back to the, you know, the steer that we brought in yesterday, and how you say it was hard to find. What are the indicators that you? I mean, is it just a duration of time to where you say it's time to take this to market?
Yeah, you look at them and you can tell when they're, as long as they're gaining. My way of doing it is that as long as the animal's on the gain, I'll I'll look at, I'll consider him. Once he's finished gaining, I mean, he's got to go.
Yeah.
But ideally, I like to process them when they're on the gain, because they seem to be in better health.
Mm.
The meat will become more rich, more colorful.
Mm.
It's going to be, the muscle will be in better tune, so therefore it's going to be more tender.
Mm.
But when they hit that peak and then they're either going to tail off or they're just going to stay there.
Plateau kind of.
Plateau it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they've, you know, you kind of missed the mark.
I see.
You
know, but interesting.
As long as they're, and you can take a look at on their hip, you can take a look at their shoulders, and you can tell they're still on the gain.
Wow. That's mesmerized.
I like how your mouth just keeps hanging open.
I'm absolutely mesmerized by all of this. And I mean, we don't get to do this enough, I think. It's, you know, I have a one carcass per week coming in, and that's great. But I think I really only get to see you maybe once every other week or so, and then right. It's just for such a brief amount of time. And I think I come up with so many questions when I actually have something here on the block that maybe I should start writing them down or something, because it's just, you know, I've got more questions than we may ever have time for, actually.
Well, we'll just have to redo this. We'll have to bring
him
back.
Yeah, we have
back
to keep doing it.
Maybe we should do a larger panel,
yeah,
too. That way,
no,
we don't want you to feel like you're being bamboozled with the center stage every time.
As long as people don't throw rocks at me, I'm okay.
We'll make sure to check the rocks at the door.
Totally throw that out of my... That's exactly what I was going to say.
Okay, we talked about the early get-up.
Yep.
We talked about kind of hunting the cows in their secret spots, hiding out under trees. And what I want to do is open up a controversial topic, though.
Mm.
And hopefully we'll get some feedback from the audience as well and from our group here in this shop. Let's talk about, because it's real pronouncedly noted on your website, Steve, about the grain-free diet. I grew up in Indiana. It's big grain focus out there. Michael and I have talked in the past about the fact that restaurant menus actually advertise corn-fed Midwest beef.
Yep.
I didn't know any different until I moved to California. Now I'm, you know, by being with Michael in the shop and eating grass-fed beef on a regular basis, I prefer it. I try not to eat grain-fed.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have an opinion and a take on this.
Well, the thing is, with grain-fed beef, and I was just like you, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Yeah, grain-fed, that's what you did.
And it's sweet and delicious, but...
Yeah, you just go out there and you get old buck in the corral, you throw him a little bit of hay and you throw him some corn and sit back and wait for him to kind of top out and you go, okay, here we go.
They're at weight and they're fattened up.
Yep. But the more you look at it, the way the cow is built, she's a ruminant, and so she's going to need that grass to stay right. healthy.
And for the listeners and for me personally, what is that word, ruminant?
She has multiple stomachs.
Okay.
And she needs those stomachs they're there to break down grasses. Or some in bad
herbs.
Years, they're there to break down brush, too. Mm. So, but, you know, it's mainly there to break down the grasses. So... You start feeding her the grain. That grain is one step beyond what she needs to be. Because when she's out walking in the pasture and she's plucking the seed heads off the grass, okay, she's also taking leaf and such like that. And so that all that goes into her stomach and starts breaking it down. And her whole digestive system, her whole all the her functions are working. They're all hitting on all cylinders. But when you take something out, like you take out that grass leaf or you take out that stem, you're shutting down one function.
Right.
And to me, that's not treating the cow properly. And I don't want to sound like I'm some sort of
right.
whack.
And I know, I know exactly where you're coming from, because we have to deal with that here, and I think that the, like you mentioned, in the restaurant realm, you know, Midwest has a connotation. Nebraska has a connotation. Grain-fed, prime. These all have marketability, and, right. and we deal with it all the time on both sides of that case. And, you know, we have had to be salesmen for this ideology, and it is rather unfortunate because we're not looking down our nose.
No,
and I think that's one. The other that's a great aspect to acknowledge. We're not trying to knock other ranchers for doing what they do for a living, but
not.
It's a philosophy.
I'd be the last person to criticize another man's way of doing things.
Right.
You know, if a gentleman wants to raise his cattle on grass and finish them on grain, and that makes him happy, by jiggity, go do it. You know?
Exactly.
That's fine. The thing is with the what we've been brought up, the corn-fed out in Nebraska, out of Iowa, that has been beat into our brain since, back in the 40s.
Absolutely.
And the reason why they did it back in the 40s is because we had to get cattle production up. We had to fatten cattle and to meet the demands during
the
market. War.
Okay, mm-hmm.
That's right.
And, okay, so they discovered, hey, you know, if we throw them corn, this is cool, you know.
Yeah.
Give them some corn, give them some oats, give them, you know, right. wheat and stuff like that, and they'll get fatter quicker. We're done.
But there's an impact to the cow and ultimately to the consumer in that regard.
Well, yeah, because the fat is a lot. You have a lot more saturated fat in a grain fattened
right.
steer than you would in a grass fattened
okay.
right.
steer or grass.
And we've talked so many times here about, you know, the nutritional profile, and it just seems to me like, because we can get into all the science of it and say, okay, you know, the grain fed has an imbalanced ratio of omega-6s to omega-3s, and since we're human beings and not chimpanzees, that our brains benefit from eating a at the very least, a balanced ratio of omega-3s and omega-6s. So we could get into all that, but it seems to me like what we're really getting toward here, like you mentioned what the word ruminant means and what a ruminant herbivore is designed or maybe has evolved, depending on where you fall on that, to end up consuming. I think we're getting to a point here where we're going, Mother Nature's already taken care of all of this.
Right.
And the more that we just concede her authority and stop meddling.
Right.
The better off we will be, the better off the planet will be, and the better off these animals will be. And lo and behold, when we consume this beef, we benefit nutritionally. So, you know, while I don't knock other operations, you know, maybe producing beef for a grain finish or maybe other markets that retail meat, you know, opting to sell a grain-fed product, I think at the end of the day, what we do here and trailing all the way back to what it is that you do is more in accordance with the natural order of things.
Right.
Just the natural order of things.
Right, and that's why your responsible cattlemen are going to cut their herds when they have to, when the rains don't come, and your grass doesn't get there, you have to cut your herd to not harm the environment, not harm the land. So when the rains do come in 6 weeks, when the grass is tall enough so you can put the cattle in on it without harming the grass growth later, you're okay. And if you have to go out, personally, a lot of times I'll go out and I'll buy a couple tons of hay to just fill that void or fill that spot.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say, you know, you're just wasting money on doing that. Well, in the long run, you're not, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you're producing a better animal, and you're saving your grass, and you're saving your land, and that's what we're in here for.
That's
you know?
Right. Without the land and the grass, what have you got?
Right.
And
you don't have anything.
This platform, the First Cut series, is definitely, for both of us, a very educational-focused opportunity. Steve, I was just at the fourth annual Excellence in Agricultural Stewardship and Sustainability Luncheon, and the things you just brought up were a heavy focus for that day. I mean, it's full of cattlemen and ranchers, and Mr. Atwater was there. Big, heavy agricultural focus. Responsible cattlemen and responsible farming was a theme that everyone really brought to the surface. Water was also a hot topic. Can we talk a little bit about how, you know, the lack of rainfall and the experience or the conditions we're experiencing in California right now affect you as a cattleman and not just a produce farmer or a citrus farmer?
Well, the lack of rain has really, really hurt us badly where we are, because we've had to pull out of pastures that we've had grass in, but we have no water. So, I mean, if we're going to leave our cattle there, that means we have to truck the water in. Okay, that can be done, but
at a cost.
Yeah, but you start trucking water, and a cow will eat on a hot day. She'll drink 30 gallons. On a cool day, she'll drink 15 gallons. So you figure, okay, 15 gallons, eight pounds per gallon. Do the math. You got 50 cows.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. You know. You know,
wow.
100 cows or whatever, you know, you're going to be okay. And you get it all done, and then guess what? You get to do it the next day.
You got
to
do it again.
Yeah, you can't do it one day and think, oh, we're good for a week. You know,
yeah, right.
So good, because we talk all the time, you know, when we do these classes or when we do the, you know, we do From the Butcher's Block, which is sort of like one and the same. We talk a lot about where prices come from. And that it's so interesting to hear you talk about, you know, the nuances of running your business and how, you know, Mother Nature has a more profound impact on what it, I mean, that she has an impact on what we all do, but gosh, that's where prices come from. And that's how this whole thing makes its way to a retail price. And, you know, it's unfortunate when you get into this realm, and this climate, I should say, and everybody's on a budget and everything, but I wish we could all just be more considerate about how it is that, how difficult it is for you to do your job in that context, and just be more considerate about those kinds of things. You know, it's very interesting.
Right. And then you throw in there on top of that, just for the giggles, is you got the government coming in and, you know, being that they know more than anybody about everything.
Well, yeah. The government.
Yeah, they're
hello.
Don't be cautious, Steve. You're gonna get Michael going. The libertarian is gonna explode.
But anyhow, they can kind of mess things up a little bit.
I don't
too,
doubt it.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, I want to reach out to the people we have in the shop real quick and just
the people,
my people, and make sure that there aren't any questions we're missing. Get them involved with the conversation, because you and I could go on for hours with Steve.
Yes.
So, Deborah.
What's the long-term effect, not only on people, but the cattle themselves, with all of the GMOs and the hormones and all the other chemicals that are going into that?
I think that although I haven't really had any experience with the GMOs, because I don't. But I feel that it's not going to be advantageous. There's going to be some sort of repercussion down the road, whether it's going to be 5 years from now, 10 or 25, you know, who knows. But it's going to come back and bite us. And that's why your responsible cattlemen are going to breed for performance, attitude, mothering, and things like that. And you take a look at J.R. Simplot, his outfit 5 years ago. Okay, now that's a big outfit. They run a lot of cattle, okay? His outfit has decided that they're going to start shutting down their feedlots, and they're going to start putting their cattle out on pastures, and use the only feedlots that they're going to keep open are going to be feeding all produce, all natural, non-grains, because they're going to, instead of, they'll feed potatoes, okay?
I see.
The guy is a huge potato farmer. And they'll feed carrots, because he grows a lot of carrots.
Mm.
But they're not going to, and the grains that they grow are going to be designed and targeted for human consumption, because they feel that they need to do that.
Mm.
So they run cattle on over 2 million acres in Idaho, Nevada, Montana, that area. And they're just, you know, they're just going to start going more grass-fed.
Yeah.
Well, they came out the other day and said, I forget the name of the guy who runs their cattle operation. He says, we're not even looking at the GMOs because there's, first of all, there's not enough information on it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it may not be bad at all. Who knows? But there's not enough. Personally, you guys, I should have been born in Missouri because you got to show me.
Right.
You know, because I'm just because you say it.
Well, that's a hot topic. We've had this discussion numerous times,
yes,
both in the shop and just you and I,
yep,
and with customers, and in First Cut, for that matter, previous class, where a attendee brought up the GMO topic. Mm. And I'm very similar to you, Steve, in the show me kind of perspective. Because, again, coming out of Purdue University, it's a big agricultural school. It's a big husbandry school as well. So when we were mentioning ruminant earlier, mm-hmm, I knew what it was but didn't know the word. Because they have their show and tell fairs where a cow comes out, it's got the big rubber bladder, you can actually reach in the stomach, and they do a lot of testing. But for me, GMO is a too broad and too generic of a term, because for centuries we've been modifying,
yeah,
produce and trees and agricultural components of our diet in some shape or form, whether it's through splicing or cross-pollinating. But where people get really scared and nervous is this perception without any real definition or details of the DNA level testing and, like, the we're splicing in different animals, and people immediately go to that thought and that vision. I don't think that's fair, but I also think that people need to do some research on their own. You know, they can't just rely on a blanket statement in regards to GMO and think, oh my God, it's bad. Because, again, men and women have been cross-pollinating citrus trees and, you know, greens and everything for hundreds of years.
Absolutely.
Thousands of years.
Right. And their selective breeding is one thing, but when you get in there and start doing with the chemicals and whatever.
At a microscopic level.
Yeah.
That's
why I can't see it, I ain't going to believe it. You know?
Right.
Yeah, here, look through this thing here, and then we'll tell you all about it.
No, right.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Well, again, you know, maybe grass-fed beef is just the solution. You know, you don't even have to worry. I mean, because we get into the conversation so much about chickens and how, you know, corn and soy just dominate chicken feed in the United States, and there's several reasons for that. It's really, really difficult to get away from chickens that are being fed corn and soy, and even now in smaller productions it makes its way in there. And, you know, certain times all we can really do here is shrug our shoulders and say, you know, if you're really that concerned about soy and you're that concerned about corn in an animal's diet, it's called grass-fed beef, and it's over here to the right, actually.
Yeah.
You know,
but unfortunately from where I sit, in my opinion, the pendulum has swung way askew. And
yes,
people's perception about GMO and organic, there's these hot button terms that are being thrown around. I was at the farmer's market last weekend, and a young lady walked up to a gentleman at his booth, beautiful greens and produce and pea vines and things I'd never heard of, but they're crisp, they're fresh, they're delicious. And she said, oh, are you organic?
Right.
And his response was, we're not certified organic.
Right.
Which is a fair statement. You know, getting certified organic takes time and money and certain regulations and checklists that have to be punched.
So she did a 180.
She did a 180. Didn't even give him the opportunity to explain what that meant.
Right.
She's heard not organic and she walked away.
Right.
And that's not fair to an agricultural farmer. It's not fair to a cattleman. That people are uneducated and don't choose to ask better questions.
Oh, absolutely. I learned this, you know, in operating this shop for 2 years, and, you know, I've probably said it enough times that, you know, my staff is probably sick of hearing it, but there is no better regulator of a market than an educated customer. That's just a matter of fact. You want answers, ask better questions. And it is limited. You know, is this organic? Is it not? You know, I've heard people like Steve say, yeah, organic is a made-up city word. Not that you've said that.
People of that ilk have said it's
a made-up city word.
I wouldn't deny that, because there are some farmers and ranchers that I've met personally who are following all the guidelines required to be certified organic, but for either for cost or time and effort or the regulation of it, they've chosen right. not to be certified.
Right,
but
because
they're following everything
well,
they
well,
need
then
to.
Then it comes full circle to go, okay, well, I've had to spend X amount of dollars to satisfy this piece of regulation so that I can have a label, and now how am I going to be competitive in the marketplace? Yeah, I've got this label here, but then the next question is going to be, well, it's organic, but it seems kind of expensive. You know, it's like, well, where do your convictions lie? You know, where do they lie?
Now, what I want to do real quick, because we've been here for about 45 minutes, and I think wouldn't be a bad time to stretch our legs for a minute. Let's take a couple-minute break.
Okay.
When we come back, I want to talk to Steve a little bit more, and Steve, not to use you in the third person, I want to find out a little bit more about the process of getting your cattle to market.
Yes. Okay.
What
we'll
channels you're using
focused.
And how people get your beef, both here locally in the Ventura Meat Company, but as a general process of a cattleman to the shop. All right? So let's all stretch our legs, and we'll be back here
for
in just a few minutes with the First Cut series, educational series. Well, Michael, welcome back to the First Cut educational series.
Welcome back.
This is our live broadcast, our first ever with this series. We're broadcasting live from the Ventura Meat Company.
Live.
Your shop.
Yes.
And we have a great guest, a special guest, Mr. Steve Carpenter from
Indeed.
Carpenter Cattle Company.
Distinguished.
I like distinguished. And very knowledgeable. For those of you who are
Good
not
Lord.
In the shop, we
you're
miss
missing
you.
Out.
Yeah, you're missing out.
Good grief.
Because there have been some conversations happening during this break that we should have had on air, but... That's
well,
okay.
That's okay.
If you'd have come into the shop, you'd have got it.
Bingo.
We have some fun stuff that fun in my opinion, but we have some things we want to focus on for this segment.
Yep.
And one of the biggest ones for me is better understanding the process, Steve, of getting your cattle from the field to the market and what that means to your operation as a business, but what you also perceive that to mean for the customer.
Okay. Typically what we do is we wean our calves at 5 to 6 months old.
Okay, and so up until that time, they're still feeding off of the mother.
They're nursing mom, but they're also learning to eat. A calf will start imitating its mom about 2 weeks old. It'll go out and it doesn't know what it's doing, but it'll eat grass.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And the stomach doesn't really, it does digest it, but it's set up for milk, you know. But 5 months, between 5 and 6 months old, we'll wean that calf. We leave the calf in the small trap for about 30 days to get over the stress of mom being gone and such like that. During that time, we feed it hay, and we can keep a close eye on it and such like that.
Okay. So acting as a second parent, largely.
Right. And then we'll select one or two old cows, and they'll be our babysitters, and we'll send them out with the calves. And so the calves don't go leaping down the road and get in trouble. They're kids, you know, they'll get in trouble.
Right.
We'll leave them out there until they get to about 900 to 950 pounds.
It's wild to me to think of an adolescent at 900 pounds, 950 pounds.
And then we bring them into what we call our water trap, and it's a 5 to 10 acre parcel. And at that time we will feed the calves a legume hay, which is an alfalfa hay, and we'll feed them carrots, and we'll feed them other produce like almond hulls or walnuts hulls or things like that. And what this does, it allows them to still to gain weight, but it takes the tang of the grass out of the fat, and it makes it a more consistent tasting animal, and the fat is almost a sweetness to it. Mm. And being that they're in a semi-flat area and such, and then they're allowed all the water and all the feed and everything that they, and they're fed in a normal condition, they're a lot more relaxed, and so therefore you don't have to worry about tightness in the muscle. You don't have to worry about adrenaline flowing through the muscle, which is all bitter. That makes some of these animals so tough and so tangy and bitter is because the last maybe 2 weeks, the way they've been handled.
Yeah.
And so, and then when we process our steers or calves, we process them at night because they're much more relaxed. And then we hang our animals for 18 to 27 days, depending upon the animal. And then we deliver it to Michael.
If we could get a little, further into that 18 to 27 days, depending on the animal, what are the things that you're looking for? What determines how long an animal hangs?
Well, what we do is when we process an animal, we kind of know what he or she has been doing.
Okay.
And we go, okay, you know, this one's going to be probably a 24-day or 27-day.
So level of activity is playing a part in this equation.
Right.
Which I guess would be moisture, because that's ultimately what we're trying to do here, is induce moisture evaporation. So certain steers would have larger concentrations of moisture in the muscle.
Right.
Interesting.
And also, you have antioxidants. You want a lot of antioxidants present in the animal's nutrition, because that helps a redder meat, a more tender meat. It helps the muscle or the fat. And so therefore, when you're looking at that animal, you're saying, you know, gosh, he's been walking around on dirt or desert for the last 6 weeks, you know. We're going to have to feed him more, and we're going to have to hang him longer because we have to bring his quality up. And, I mean, this is what – I mean, without us being able to provide to the customers a consistent high quality, or whether high quality, low quality, whatever, consistent quality meat product. So you, when you come in and you buy it, in November, or you buy it in March, or you buy it in July, it's the same quality. You know that what you're going to be, when you go home, you throw that steak on the Barbie.
Right.
That's what it's going to
be. It's the same thing that fast food restaurants have been doing for ages. It's like, you know, a cheeseburger in St. Louis at a McDonald's is going to be the same one in Miami. Right?
Sure.
Same kind of idea.
I want to walk backward a little bit, even before the hanging of the cattle for that aging process we're talking about. Steve, you've mentioned in numerous different ways throughout our conversation temperament, dispatching the animals at night so they're more relaxed, painting the fences certain colors, and, you know, keeping those animals at a low stress level.
Right.
I watched a documentary on Temple Grandin. I'm not sure if you've seen or have familiarity.
Yeah. Familiar.
I think it's an amazing documentary on her perspective of what it took to keep a cow relax and quality beef and a humane processing. And Mike, we talked in the past about these kind of feel good terms. You're slaughtering the cow. I mean, that's how you get a cow to market. It's a living animal. We have to kill it and dress it accordingly. But with all these things you've mentioned and the theme of a relaxed and calm animal, what is the direct impact? If that animal is not calm, if there is a stress factor, for some reason, it's worked up. What is the direct impact to the quality of the meat?
It's gonna really diminish the quality of the meat greatly, because when an animal tightens up out of fear or anxiety or something, he's got adrenaline running through his body, and he's going to tighten up, and all your tender, what's normally going to be tender, is going to be tough because the muscle is all tightened up.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like you when you look up in the rearview mirror and the entire world is a red light flashing.
Right.
You get that little bitter taste in your right here.
Yeah.
That's adrenaline. Right. Same thing with a cow.
And it will taint it'll taint the meat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
flavor wise, not just toughness, but flavor as well.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yep.
Now, just to focus on that a little bit more. Do you have a take on the flow that a cow has to walk in order to get through the process? Or, you know, 'cause again, Temple Grandin's documentary is about, you know, these weaving and winding
right.
routes.
They have,
and
what they like to do is they like to walk them in a, not a semicircle, but close to it, like a snake type deal, and then they walk them slowly up. It's a very gradual incline. And when they get to the top of the incline, that's when they're processed. Mm.
Okay.
And you're talking about Ken Short's place?
No, I'm talking about at Manning's Beef down.
Oh,
down
I see. Okay, got it, got it.
Now, but you also referenced, Steve, that you're processing the cattle on your ranch. So
no,
we
process our cattle on at Manning's Beef. We ship our cattle.
You ship them down.
I see.
Okay.
So got it.
Manning's Beef, and we ship them at night.
So, okay, you're not actually doing it at your location. You put them on a truck, get them to Manning's, and in the evening when they're kind of relaxed, that's
right.
when Manning's takes care of it. So they're an overnight operation, which I didn't realize.
I didn't know
processing
they
took place overnight.
They process them about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Which is another factor that the consumer has, most consumers, 99% have no clue about. Like you said just now, they're probably sleeping.
Yep.
So the quality beef in the case that they're expecting to be there happened when they're snoozing and seeing their...
Right, and effectively it happened 18 to 27 days ago.
Right.
You know? So, but you mentioned...
But
that's
an employment, that's a job
right.
that someone has to do. Someone has
absolutely.
To be just like truckers and, you know, 24-hour support desk people.
Right.
That's a job that most people are not going to want to do because, very minimum, the hours suck.
Right. And but to go back to your question to Steve about, you know, do you do the processing on your ranch? Well, you wouldn't be able to sell it to the public if you did that.
Correct.
And you, there's nothing stopping you from doing that other than the fact that you want to sell the cattle that you raise. And that is a federal piece of regulation. You wouldn't be able to sell it to the public. Anthony has a question.
So the question is about the slaughter and the process that takes to dispatch an animal. There are some trucks out there that will show up mobily to your site. And so, Steve, Anthony wants to know if there's an opportunity to get that FDA-approved mobile processing facility, would you entertain that? Or how does that work into your business?
Okay, what that can do, what you do is when you have a Ken Short, okay, we can utilize his, what they call, mobile slaughter truck, but that would be only for... if that individual steer was sold to a single family or a single person.
Okay.
It could not be sold to Michael's place.
It can't be broken
like,
into
like
portions
retail.
To different retail. It's got to be direct to consumer.
It has to go from our sole ranch to the sole consumer.
Yeah. Okay.
That's
and I imagine that has a profound impact on price.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. Buy your grass-fed beef at a butcher shop.
It's I was going to say, Michael, so a shameless self-plug is go to the butcher shop where the cost will be better. The price will be better.
Well, you'd have to take that steer and then take it to a butcher shop and have the butcher.
Well, there you go.
Right
absolutely,
there.
Absolutely.
And then he would have to the mobile butcher or slaughter would have to dispose of the hide and
right.
the other.
So while you think that you're cutting out a middleman, there's just another middleman that steps in his place.
You're just changing middlemen.
Yeah. Wow.
That's interesting. Now, I know the answer is going to be yes, Steve, but I'm looking for a little more depth. You're eating some of your own cattle, right? Are you still having a facility process that steer for you, or are you doing it on the ranch yourself?
That's interesting.
For your own personal consumption.
I have Kent Short do it.
Okay. And we keep referencing Kent Short. That is it's old country butcher. Old fashioned country butcher in Santa Paula.
Yep.
And another facility that people probably don't realize will process game in that as well.
When he has time.
Yeah, that's a fair statement to make.
It's like getting an appointment with the Pope.
Well, you know, it's funny because we get the phone calls here. You know, hey, you know, I've just killed a couple of deer, and I'm looking for a place. Well, don't you think you should have thought of that before you?
Yeah, you owe it to the animal to have
a
plan in place before you go out hunting.
You know?
Yeah. So Michael, you mentioned, though, that the steer you brought in yesterday from Steve, almost 800 pounds, 760 pounds, carcass weight. Mm-hmm. Steve, how big is your family, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, it's just my wife and I now.
So you're not eating 760 pounds of beef. What are you doing with the rest of that steer? Do you, are you sharing it with
friends? Oh, I share it with my kids.
Okay.
Instead of paying them to help me work the cows,
yeah,
I pay them in beef.
I think that's a fair trade.
That's a great
trade. My family used to split up, and part of why I was intrigued by that is in Indiana, my family used to buy a side and split it, but there were five different families that would consume that. So being able, you know, having your own single cow, that's probably good for a couple of months.
Oh, yeah. We do a lot of barter. I haven't paid for a plumber or electrician in years.
There's nothing wrong with that.
That's awesome.
And I think it, you know, we, as we mentioned, the Ventura Meat Company is carrying Steve's, Steve Carpenter's beef.
Indeed.
And his cattle. But it speaks volumes for me that the rancher is eating the cattle that he's raising.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't expect anything less, but it still speaks to me as high quality. Like, if he would consume it, then we should feel comfortable consuming it.
Good enough for me, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's good to have somebody look in the eye and somebody's hand to shake, you know? I mean, that's something that I guarantee you you're not going to get really anywhere else.
This is true.
You know, the guy, I don't want to point any fingers at any particular retailers, but, you know, if you go to the grocery store, I sincerely doubt, not only do they not know an individual, they have no triangulation on where any of this.
And unfortunately, I think a lot of those individuals, probably have no fault of their own, don't have the level of education to recommend certain cuts or to explain to you cooking techniques of those cuts or where they came from on the animal.
Exactly. That's not what they're paid to do. And the people that we have working here, they are paid to do that. Yeah. That's the difference.
So, Steve, I promised the people that I would ask the question, and I know that Michael prepped you for it, so there's a – I need to be schooled on this.
I had no part in this.
Growing up in the Midwest, it was a big thing for people to talk about going cow tipping.
I had no part in this.
But Michael informed me that you said that's an old wives' tale. It's kind of a snipe hunt type of thing. I personally never went because I found it – I thought the idea of it to be ridiculous – but you're saying it actually doesn't exist anyway. Can you, what's it up that cow tipping is a thing or not?
Okay. When I went to school in Texas,
yeah,
these old boys down there, they took out some guys from Massachusetts, and they said, "We're going to go cow tipping." Okay. And they took them down the road to this rodeo arena. And there's some bulls out in the in the pens, and they say, "Go knock one over." He's the one that has the big horns. He's easy to knock over because he's off balance because he's got those horns.
It makes sense. It stands to reason.
Yeah,
I get it.
Yeah, we had to carry the guy back.
All right, that I see the error of my thought process there. So that Chris Farley scene when he's out.
Well, it's a belly option on three.
Yeah, it totally. It's just Hollywood. Just Hollywood. All right, we're getting close to the end of our session. I want to throw it back out to the people we have in the shop and make sure there aren't any questions we missed. We could go on for hours, I'm sure. But
good Lord.
Are there any kind of wrap-up questions we want to get with Steve? Yeah, and maybe, Steve, as we kind of wind up, you can talk about some of those simple processes that Doug's referring to and that you chatted about on the break. Because I think people have lost sight to a large degree. You mentioned you don't you don't ride vehicles on your property. You try to walk and ride horses as much as possible. Correct. To me, that's a very rooted practice. You know, that's what was done 200 years ago.
Right.
How simplified do you try to be with your ranch? What does it mean to you to have a facility?
We try to keep it as basic and simple as possible. For instance, in October, on our better pastures, we'll go through and we have a drag that we pull behind our pickup. And it's 16 foot wide by 16 foot long. And it's basically a chain link fence, and we have tires in the middle of this drag. And then in the middle of the tires, we put these tubs and we drill holes in them, and we put we seed, we put grass seed in there. Okay. Fescue, seed, gamma grass, things like that. In order to, it's an improvement or improved pasture type of seed. And we drag the field with it and knock down the cow turds. And so therefore, when the rains come, you don't get, you get a, the being that the manure is already dissipated out and spread out, the rains come and it'll melt the manure into the ground and therefore increase the running capacity of that pasture.
So you're getting a very even distribution of both the fertilizer, manure, cow poop, and the seed.
Right. And you can, this helps also helps guard against overgrazing, and also it helps the improvement of the types of grasses, because you want better grasses. The better grasses you have, the better nutrition the cow will get. The better nutrition, the better the meat. That's what
and I think ultimately, Michael, you can attest by being on the other side of the case, the better nutrition your customers are getting.
Absolutely. And it seems, you know, there's so much, and I know that you know about all this stuff. Red meat has been largely demonized over the past quarter century, the past 30 years or something like that. But I think, you know, people that really peel back the layers know better. Yep. That it is a profoundly nutritional product. I happen to think that grass-fed beef is one of the most superb foods that human beings can consume. And when it's done in accordance with all of those processes, that it is a highly nutritional product. And I eat it, you eat it. You know, I consider myself to be a pretty fit fella, so I'm going to keep eating.
You look pretty trim.
I'm going to keep eating a lot of grass-fed beef.
So, well, we want to wrap it up for the evening. We're getting on our mark. Steve, I want to reach over. It's been a pleasure. I really want to thank you, and I'm honored to have had this conversation. We also want to let everyone, both in the shop and online listening, go to www.carpentercattlecompany.com. Learn a little bit more about the Carpenter Cattle Company. Find them on Facebook. If you already are consuming their beef, give them a like on Facebook as well.
Instagram and a Pinterest too.
Follow these guys. They're doing it the right way. You know, Steve is out there. He knows his cattle, as you've heard. He knows his fields and his pasture. And
he's
going to
be up in about 2 hours,
Yeah, it means a better product for you. Also, the Ventura Meat Company. Go check out the VenturaMeatCompany.com. Michael, you're putting out some really cool articles lately about not only just what's in the shop, but how you're integrating with the community.
Yep.
And follow them on Facebook. And then if you're already watching online with Everybody's Hungry, you know where to go. But everybodyshungry.org, we're on all those major platforms, too. Thank you, everyone, both here in the shop and online. It's been a great discussion. We're going to have to continue this, Michael.
Good Lord, aren't we?
We'll get Steve in an earlier time so we're not impeding on his sleep for the next day's work. But
well, he probably works pretty late, too, so I don't know. I don't know where that window is. But
whatever.
Again, I thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure to sit here at this table with you.
Really great.
Everyone who's been listening, this is the First Cut educational series at the Ventura Meat Company, broadcasting through our other show, the Butcher's Block Show, from the Butcher's Block. So thank you all for listening. And have a great night.